Thank you. For those of you who don't know, the Annenberg Center presents educational activities for physicians, patients, and the general public in many different formats, from continuing medical education activities, community lectures, and convening events. I'm pleased this afternoon to introduce our moderator for this afternoon's session, Siobhan O'Connor. Siobhan is the Director of Health for Time and Time.com. She is also an award-winning journalist and editor. So please join me in welcoming Siobhan O'Connor.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us for this really exciting seminar, The Future of Medicine. It couldn't be broader, but it also couldn't be more exciting. It's probably news to no one in this room that we're going through an incredible progress boom when it comes to science and medicine. They say that every 2 years, scientific knowledge doubles, but if you look at just what's happened since the top of 2016, we've seen stunning advances in cancer immunotherapy, in organ transplants that had previously never been tried in the United States, in genetic testing, and thanks to CRISPR, in genetic tinkering. So, you know, for me as a health journalist, it's obviously, it's an exciting time, it's sort of overwhelming, and to be quite honest, it's hard. It's a hard time. It's hard to keep up with the progress, which is why I frankly can't imagine what these wonderful people, how they keep up, basically, with the rate of scientific progress when they have, you know, real jobs with lives on the line and cancer hospitals to run and research hospitals to run. So I am very honored to introduce our three panelists today. We have Vivian Lee, who is the CEO of Utah Health Center Healthcare, Dr. Ken Davis, who's the CEO and president of Mount Sinai, and Toby Cosgrove from the Cleveland Clinic. Now, we have a lot of ground to cover today, so just a couple of things before we get started. We're going to ask that we keep the questions on the brief-ish side so that we can let our audience members also sort of have at you. And I'm just going to say a couple of things about sort of where we are in medicine and science today to sort of key us up for the conversation that's going to follow. So first of all, it's obviously a it's a tricky time, it's a dicey moment for this country, but the Affordable Care Act is here. It has dramatically changed medicine, and though it's been challenged, it looks for now like it's here to stay. Second, like I said, the pace of progress in medicine and science is absolutely astounding. It's breathtaking, and the race to develop, you know, life-altering, high-tech therapies, that's very, very real, and at the same time, we have tens of millions of Americans who are dealing with chronic, sometimes preventable diseases that require day-to-day management, and that's expensive and it's intensive. And finally, we have, you know, health systems have the most demanding patients than they ever have before. Dr. Lee, you like to talk about the millennification of medicine, and that's very, very real. You know, the patient-centered approach and the expectations of patients and customers at hospitals and healthcare centers has changed dramatically. So that's a lot. That's sort of just setting the framework for sort of where we are. And, you know, we'll have a lot of opportunities in the next few days to talk about the challenges that are facing medicine. But before we get into that, I wanted to go sort of pie in the sky with these three, you know, brilliant CEOs and physicians and say, you know, when you look at the technological advances that we have in front of us right now and forthcoming, what excites you the most? What has the most potential to absolutely transform medicine? Dr. Cosgrove, why don't we start with you?
Well, I think one of the most exciting things we have going right now is the human genome and the understanding of the origins of life and the things that begin to alter both disease and wellness in individuals. I was talking the other day with Craig Venter, who told me that now he's now located the area on the human genome that can define what a person's face looks like.
Wow.
And tell you what your color of your eyes, your skin, your complexion, your bone structure of your face. Pretty exciting stuff.
That is exciting, but that also raises all kinds of questions.
Raises a lot of questions. But once again, you're not going to hold back the progress of science, and so we have to learn how to deal with it.
Absolutely. Dr. Davis?
Well, what excites me in the short term is what we've learned about immunology and immunotherapy and how it's affecting cancer treatment. The breakthroughs have been remarkable. There are colleagues of mine at Mount Sinai who talk about how for 3 and 4 decades from the beginning of their careers, they worked in immunology to answer the question of why do cancers fool the immune system such that the immune system doesn't attack the cancer and get rid of it. And now we're seeing the fruits of decades of that laboring come to fruition. We see amazing therapies, vaccines, and I see in a lot of our experimental treatments, people who have been considered hopeless being put into remission. So that's very, very exciting. In the long run, what I look forward to is breakthroughs in neuroscience, that we're finally going to do something about the brain diseases that we have done so little about since the kind of happenstance discoveries of a bunch of drugs that were psychoactive on antidepressants, antipsychotics. All those drugs were by accident, good observations, but not theoretical science. But in the long term, I think we're going to break through in that barrier too and get us some really important drugs that can make a difference.
And I want to go back to that in a little while, but why it's taken so long for that progress. But first, Dr. Lee.
Well, I think what you've just heard, I would definitely reiterate, genetics, immunology, neuroscience, they are the frontiers that we're tremendously excited about going forward. Maybe what I could add to that is just to say that I think that one of the things that I think that we are going to all try to struggle with is the accelerating pace of technology and the advances in knowledge and the big data that we're actually just about to drown in. And how do we take that big data and take all of these new discoveries and really translate them into action and to start to think about the culture of healthcare and how we can influence the culture of healthcare so that the great technological advances that we see can really impact human health. I worry that there's going to be a widening gap between what we can do and what we actually do in terms of influencing the health of the population. So I'd say that's one of the biggest challenges we're facing.
So one of the things that all three of you are very familiar with is sort of how your hospital systems have had to adapt to exactly what you just said, this incredible sort of like lurch forward and then while also caring for people day to day. Dr. Davis, I'd like to hear from you about how you balance the sort of robust research institution, that sort of directive at Sinai up against the patient populations that you're dealing with, very socioeconomically diverse, particularly in New York City, and what that sort of looks like.
It's a huge challenge. The margins that we used to generate more effectively from a hospital system would support the research that we did. Now remember, the NIH budget really hasn't gone up for over a decade. There's been a small increase lately, and perhaps in the next 4 to 8 years, there'll be a reawakening of interest in science and funding it, but it's been relatively flat. Which that means is that the most conservative grants, the most grants that you know are going to be successful are generally ones that are funded. So high-risk research, the kind of real breakthrough research that you'd like to see, is rarely funded. So how do we support that? How do we support young investigators getting started and people with great ideas that really can't get funding initially, but we think are great ideas? Well, we used to be able to do it in part from a hospital margin, but now increasingly we do it from philanthropy. And we're very, very fortunate in New York that we have an extraordinary group of trustees, they give us, you know, very, very large amounts of money. And with that money, we're able to support the kind of science that we think is critical and breakthrough.
Dr. Cosgrove, do you want to build upon that a little bit?
Yeah, to put it in perspective, the Affordable Care Act essentially said that we needed to improve the quality and to cover more people and decrease costs. That was a big order.
Yes.
And just let's zero in on those three things. We've seen 13 million more people covered with some sort of insurance, mostly through Medicaid. Mm-hmm. We've seen the quality metrics across the country gradually improve. And we've seen the inflation rate of healthcare come progressively down since 2008. Now, the reasons for that are complicated, but nonetheless. But at the same time, we've seen the reimbursement for everything we do in healthcare decrease. For example, physicians and Medicare now will have an inflation rate over the 5-year period of 2%. 1% a year, 1% a year, and then zero for the next 3 years. That clearly is not going to keep up with inflation. Similarly, we'll be having a reduction in what we get paid by Medicare, about 1% a year. And we're seeing a bigger and bigger population moving into the Medicare age. So There is substantial financial pressure on every hospital across the country, no question about it. So we planned, just to give you a sense of it, we're about, 3 years ago, we were about a $6.5 billion organization, and we reckoned over 5 years that we had to take $1.5 billion out of our cost. And that has been a big challenge. And I think every organization across the country is dealing with the same thing. And so we are dependent upon philanthropy. We are dependent upon driving the efficiency of our organization and all of our entire system. But it is changing. This is the biggest change that has happened in healthcare in a century. Right. And it affects, and it's the biggest industry in the United States, and affects 100% of the people in the United States. So this is a big deal for this country, and we're trying to deal with it. And all of us, I think everybody in healthcare that I've talked to is struggling with this same thing.
Yep. Dr. Lee, you've spoken about your, heard your lemonade stand story when you were a little girl, and how you've sort of applied that to when you got to Utah and you looked around and said, okay, so what does it cost to run an MRI machine for 2 minutes? And you couldn't get an answer. And what does it cost for a pediatrician to see a child for 7 minutes? Couldn't get an answer. So can you talk to us a little bit about that? Because I thought that was really innovative and exciting, and it seems like what you've learned has been something that has drawn attention from a lot of other hospital centers across the country.
Yeah, so that's a great question. So about 5 years ago, I started in this role at the University of Utah overseeing the healthcare system, and I was relatively new to this role. I should have just called up these two guys because I would have gotten some really great tips. But what I was increasingly hearing about was, you know, healthcare systems need to drive cost out, and you really need to drive value. And, you know, in most industries, the industries are already structured to be value-driven, right? So you know your costs, and then most businesses apply a little margin to that. That's your profit, and then those are what you charge the customer. In healthcare, we've really almost completely disconnected what we charge and what it actually costs us to run the business, because it runs through insurance and third-party payers, and we sort of have disconnected that. And so when I started in this new role, you know, I was told, okay, we've got to get our costs down. So I said, okay, well, where's our cost dashboard? Where's my value dashboard, since I'm supposed to be driving value? And where's the same tool for all of our physicians who are ordering out the tests and actually creating a lot of those costs, or at least responsible for those costs? And it turns out we really didn't have them. We had system-wide costs, like all hospitals have system-wide costs. We knew overall what we were spending on labor, overall pharmacy, overall supplies. But to be really actionable, you know, at the level of the individual OBGYN who's caring for a pregnant woman through the course of her pregnancy and labor and delivery, that individual did not have the data to really understand the costs that were being spent by him or her, you know, to care for the patient. So we worked pretty hard over a few years to just cost out everything, to cost out what it took for every minute in the OR, the ER, the MRI machine, or what it cost to take care of a pregnant woman throughout the course of her pregnancy. And then have now, over the last 2 and 3 years, been giving that back to the providers. And, you know, as a physician now wearing the other hat, I've never seen that cost data before. You know, I would say that most of us going through training never looked at dollars. We never knew what we charged, much less what it actually cost us to provide that care. So if you know that, sitting from where you sit and whatever industries you've come from, is it any surprise that we can't keep our costs down? We just don't know what our costs really are to run the businesses. So that was a real aha for us, and it's just been so eye-opening. And once we've given the data to the providers, you know, we're very motivated. We're very competitive. We see some costs are a little higher, like Joe's costs are a little higher than Sally's. I mean, they're pretty motivated to try to bring those in line. So it's been very effective in helping us drive those costs.
Actually, we've taken that a step that's sort of interesting, that at the end of every operation, the surgeon gets a bill for everything that he has used during the operation. So every suture, every pack, every implant, every sponge, it's all totaled up. So he can see, you know, how much he has spent on the process of doing that operation. And it's a real eye-opener, you can imagine.
So imagine a group of surgeons, and Toby is one, so he will know this very, very well. And you have this tool, so we have the same tool. You can see we're all kind of evolving in the same direction. Ours is called ORCA, O-R, cost accounting tool, so our ORCA tool. They have it on their iPads. They see what their costs are, and then they see what every other cardiothoracic surgeon spent for the same operation. And there's a little chart that says, oh, Dr. Smith, you're the fifth highest, most expensive surgeon of the group, and your outcomes are the same. So at the same time, we're also tracking outcomes.
Well, that's key,
in
right?
No way do we want to jeopardize patient outcomes. But your outcomes are the same, but you're expensive. And they, I mean, we have story after story of these guys and gals running into each other saying, well, you know, I think if I just get rid of that laparoscopic dilator, which I never use, maybe I can get those costs down. It's very motivating.
It's like the gamification of...
And by the way, doctors are slightly competitive, in case you hadn't.
Just a little bit.
That's really funny. So what, I mean, just to build on that a little bit more, what sorts of excess spending or redundancies, what was revealed through these exercises of really looking at the data?
Well, one of the things that we found immediately, which may be obvious to some of you, but which wasn't apparent to me, was just how much variability there was, for example, in supplies. So one of the first things that most people look at when they look at cost, because it's very easy to look at, is total joint replacements. So that's the artificial hips and knees. You know, everybody here in Colorado and back home in Salt Lake, you know, all the weekend warriors need a lot of those. So when we looked at those, we found that there was a threefold difference in, say, hips, artificial hips. And because we were also at the same time looking at patient outcomes, we could show the orthopedic surgeons that the outcomes for those threefold different hip prostheses were exactly the same. Does that surprise you? Probably not, right? And so that really was those kinds of things really helped us negotiate and drive more standardization. And then there were some things that we discovered that some of the data actually helped us change the way we cared for patients. So, for example, one of the areas that the orthopedic surgeons felt was very important in terms of good outcomes for patients was that the patients had to get up and out of bed the day of surgery. So after you get an artificial hip or an artificial knee, you're up and out of bed. And we discovered, looking at our cost data, that about a third of our patients were staying a little bit longer and having a slightly higher rate of complications and readmissions. And it turns out they weren't getting up and out of bed the day of surgery. And when we dug in a little more deeply, it turned out it was because the physical therapists were on a regular shift, say from 8 to 5, and the patients who weren't getting the PT were those who got out late in the afternoon.
So it's just these
logistical... So we just created two shifts of physical therapists. So,
you know, if the audience listened to this and they came to hear about breakthroughs, you're probably wondering, this sounds like a catastrophe. This is hardly a breakthrough, right? And you listen to all this discussion of expense reduction, which we all live in, and this is the world I live in every day, and you're probably wondering, well, how can my premiums keep going up, right? And the reality is, it's because the technology and the science also drives cost. The breakthroughs drive cost. I mean, the ability to use robotic surgery, laparoscopic surgery, the reasons that we can do a lot of the things that we've done, and you see it all the time now in pharmaceuticals, is there's a lot of cost that's associated with science.
So speaking of breakthroughs, you know, you can't talk about the future of medicine without talking about big data. Big data, it's a buzzword. And I feel like every, you know, couple months, at least in my field, you hear, like, the golden age of precision medicine is here, it's arrived. But it hasn't really arrived. I think you touched on this in the introductory comments, that, you know, we have all this data, we just don't know what to do with it. And so there are various ways that people are trying to figure out what to do with it, sort of pair data with actual knowledge and then action. But so where are we, and when will this golden age actually be upon us? We'll start with you, Dr. Davis.
Well, we're better off than we were. And I think you really see that now in some cancer treatments, because personalized medicine done in the right places, where they really do a full genome scan of that tumor, can often, not often, but sometimes indicates that traditional therapeutics is not the course, that a drug that might be used for another cancer is really the drug that should be used for your cancer. So that's quite personalized, and that saves lives. To some degree, we're a little more personalized when we know what your likely responsivity to some drugs might be, that you can't tolerate a particular drug. But we're not yet there because, in fact, it's hard to mine all the data. It's hard to manage it all. It's hard to get it to the patients. We don't have a totally interchangeable medical records. Patients, surprisingly, don't often access their data as much as they would. But it's also because a lot of the information isn't actionable. It isn't quite actionable yet. It will be. I mean, the future of medicine is that it could be much more actionable down the road. We would expect that when we learn much more about genomics and proteomics and how genes interact and what really makes you sick or vulnerable, and I think that's particularly where you want to be. You want to be able to be predictive in your personalized medicine. I think that's going to be the future. Right. And then we'll have real personalized medicine.
Well, you know, one of the things that you have to do is, first of all, you have to collect the data, and then secondly, you have to analyze the data. And so we put together a company called Explorus, which collected all this data and about 50 million patients' records, and now that is combined with IBM, with IBM's Watson. Interesting, Watson has been going to school at the Cleveland Clinic now, medical school now, for the last 3 years. Serious. And Watson has now learned how to take the patient's history, the patient's physical findings, the patient's chemistries, and has given a better problem list than a doctor can do. Wow. So you stop and think now, with Watson now being able to do this, and we think that as the total amount of knowledge explodes, you're going to have somebody help you do this. Because let's look at cancer, for example, that you use. I mean, you have three or four different kinds of cancer. You've got the genomics that go to the cancer. You've got a dozen different chemotherapeutic agents that you use. You have the patient's renal function and size and weight and gender, and all these things go into the decision-making about what you give and what's the right drug. And I don't think anybody can keep that all in their head. So we are looking for the help that Watson brings, and Watson is going to be part of our new health education campus, because we think that it's going to be a tool that are going to help doctors deal with this incredible explosion of knowledge that's coming at us.
Mm-hmm. So what does that look like? So theoretically, like a doctor will then input, can you describe to me what it actually
is? Well, this is already happening at Sloan Kettering, for example. They are using this for lung cancer.
Right.
And the decision making they use for lung cancer, and it's spreading across the country, those technologies that they're putting together.
Mm-hmm. The challenge is creating a tool that is, you know, where all of us as physicians are making this transition or have made the transition to electronic medical records, and how do you find the right balance where it's helpful and not just 50,000 alerts that keep popping up? And I think that's where Watson, you know, it's just taking it to a whole other level in terms of the artificial intelligence, you know.
Let's talk a little bit more about the embracing of technology. I know at Cleveland Clinic you now do virtual reality autopsies on cadavers, and you have, like you said, put IBM Watson through med school, or you are right now. I'd like to hear from all three of you. What do we hope that ultimately this will yield? Or how, I guess more pressingly, how long do you think it'll take for this to yield like real changes in the way that medicine is practiced?
Well, I think, you know, so let me tell you what we're doing with our relationship with Microsoft. Microsoft had developed a HoloLens, which is virtual reality goggles. We are planning to no longer teach anatomy with a cadaver, but we're going to teach it with virtual reality. Just to give you an example, the other day I have the goggles on and I'm walking around this cadaver, and they say, Toby, stick your head in. So I stick my head in like this, and my head is inside the chest cavity. I'm looking down on the diaphragm. Now, as 40 years as a chest surgeon, I never look down on the diaphragm like this. It's just not possible, because you got all those other organs and stuff in the way. So you can see the tracks in the brain and walk around and look at them from different directions. I mean, this is pretty exciting stuff, and you can imagine that. You're now thinking, this is teaching anatomy, but think about, okay, you're now looking at a new molecule, and you can walk around the molecule and say, okay, another nitrogen up here, another hydrogen up here. It's pretty exciting stuff, and we think that this is going to shave time off the teaching process, and frankly, you know, just think about how much better the social life is going to be for first-year medical students who don't smell like formaldehyde anymore.
Speaking of medical students, one thing I think a lot about, we all know that there's, you know, impending current doctor shortages that are projected to become worse. Doctor burnout is reportedly at an all-time high. I think the American Medical Association is having a sort of crisis panel in a couple months about this exact topic. How do we fix that? I mean, that's one very innovative way. I know that this is something that you've thought about too, Dr. Lee. How do we help the doctors of today deal with the future of medicine that we're talking about right now?
No, I think it's tied a little bit to some of the questions you already asked. Mm-hmm. That you know, we're getting a lot of external pressure to fix healthcare. You know, we're responsible for dragging the U.S. economy down, and so there's kind of a lot of weight on our shoulders. And at the same time, there's all this data coming out telling us, or potentially helping us, to do better, like the OR costing tools for the surgeons. And so I actually feel, certainly it's working in our institution at the University of Utah, where if you're able to provide the data back to the providers, to the physicians, it's extremely empowering. Because they're smart, they're very good self-learners, they're very motivated, they're very competitive. And so if you give them data and they're able to say, see their own quality metrics go up, see their patient satisfaction scores go up, see the costs going down, they're all of a sudden empowered and part of the solution instead of part of the problem. And I actually feel that that's actually very, very important in this day and age.
This is Aspen Public Radio, broadcasting on KJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale. We're broadcasting live from the Aspen Institute Spotlight Health on a discussion titled The Future of Medicine.
I know an oncologist who's nearing retirement who says medicine has been ruined. Medicine has been ruined by electronic medical records, which take too much of his time, by insurance companies that deny claims all the time and all the work that he's doing, by the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, and Obamacare, and the networks that it's establishing, and that doctors are increasingly becoming employed. And he says to his son, I don't think you should go into medicine. Don't go into medicine. It's just not the fun it used to be anymore. So his son doesn't go into medicine and goes into other activities that are very philanthropic. He's helping a lot of poor people do a lot of things and not working for a lot of not-for-profits. And suddenly he says to himself, you know, I really want to be a doctor. And he goes into medicine, and he knows all about electronic medical records and IT, and he knows he's going to be an employed physician, and he just doesn't care. Because what he wants to do is help people. And I think what's going to happen, more than anything else that we can do, is the selection will change. The people who want to go into medicine will hear what it's like, will understand the differences. They're not going to be the kind of people who, when I was growing up, wanted to put a shingle in the corner of their community and be a little private doctor in a little corner. That's just not medicine anymore. They're going to be people who really want to either be on the cutting edge of science, do breakthrough things, do really exciting things, or really help people in ways that haven't been possible before. And when we select those people, I don't think we're going to have the kind of problems that I hear from a lot of angry older physicians who just can't deal with change.
You know, I totally agree. And I want to build on that. I had to give a talk at the Institute of Medicine about the future of academic medicine. And in preparation for that, I was trying to put myself in the minds of our medical students and our residents. And I had a couple of town halls with the students. And I asked them, you know, how many of you remember life before Google? Okay? Like, two hands went up. How many of you all think Mark Zuckerberg is kind of old? Okay, that's most, because he's in his 30s, they're in their 20s. Just remember, there's a little bit of a difference there. How many of you remember life before healthcare reform? They all came into healthcare post, you know, they were born in the 1990s. Just let that sink in for a second, 1990s. And so, you know, the first time that Hillary Clinton was around talking about healthcare reform, that they were in preschool. So they come into healthcare, I totally agree with you, Ken, they came into healthcare thinking that they're going to be part of the solution. And actually, I think they really are. You know, one of the things that we've launched a few years ago was posting our patient satisfaction scores online. So all of the patient reviews of our doctors, and we sort of score them with the same five yellow stars, just like on Yelp or like Amazon or TripAdvisor. And it was just this huge big deal in the medical center because all the physicians are saying, oh my gosh, you're ruining our lives. The students think that that is just, of course, that's, you know, we just rolled it out for the residents. Nobody batted an eye because they grew up with Yelp and they grew up with TripAdvisor. And so, of course, they would expect that their patients should be able to review them and give that feedback. They're the future.
Actually, we just went through looking at this across our organization. The burnout rate across the country is about 50%.
Right.
And so what we decided to do is have town hall meetings. Because as we surveyed and we surveyed everybody into figuring out what was the major problem, regardless of whether the doctors or where it was all the rest of the staff in the hospital, the biggest problem was communication. And we're going through this enormous change, and basically they needed to understand and have a communication that came to them, and they understood what was going on. So we have doubled up, doubled down, tripled down on communication in every way that you can imagine. And it is amazing, we're already starting to see the increasing understanding of where we're going and why we're going, such that they can help them make this change that's going on. But they're under a tremendous amount of pressure. Our docs saw 3.5 million emails last year to answer. And there are something like 880,000 articles written every year. How do you keep up with it? I mean, it's a huge change that is stressing the physicians, but I think the communication of the changes that are happening are really the key to making them understand and begin to deal with the situation.
So we have about 10 minutes before we're going to go to the audience, maybe about 15. So there's some specific areas of sort of scientific progress that I would love for us to talk about, starting with you, Dr. Davis. Before you became CEO, you were very important scientist in neurodegenerative diseases and with a focus on Alzheimer's, and your work was obviously pioneering in that area. And now, you know, we are seeing some really interesting developments in drugs that could potentially slow the progression of Alzheimer's. Yeah, exactly. Well, okay, so let's give the mic to you.
Yeah, we'd like to hear about those drugs. Here's a little story. When I gave the first drugs that improved human memory, which is what I did it in around 1977. And when I wrote the paper that concluded that this had implications for Alzheimer's disease, and then went on to do the first tests of those drugs in Alzheimer's disease, and then the drugs like galantamine and Exelon and Aricept and Reminil and Tacrin were all launched, I thought, by the time I'm at an age risk for Alzheimer's disease, we're never going to need those drugs. You know, we'll go way beyond those drugs. We'll know how to slow the disease. But that hasn't happened. So the question is, how have we gone with so many decades, and yet there hasn't been the kind of science that has given us the breakthrough? I think there have been a lot of false starts. But the good news is, I think with the help of some imaging studies, and I'll tell you about it, and some genetic studies, I think we're now on the right course. We now know that the changes that happen in your brain that precede Alzheimer's disease happen 25 years before you're symptomatic and get a diagnosis. So for 25 years, your brain is developing plaques and some tangles, and it can be imaged. And what that means is there's a marker to begin therapy decades before you have the disease. So drugs can now be targeted in such a way that if you can slow that progression, say by 50%, before you're symptomatic, you'll die of something else. And what we've also learned by genomic studies is that the group of genes that seem to most affect the outcome and that pathology in the Alzheimer's brain have to do with inflammation. And we've got to start developing drugs that target those inflammatory pathways. And there are some that are conceptualized and some that are going to be in, in trials. So I'm optimistic that in the long run, we're really going to be able to slow the progression. Will it be in time for me? I don't think so.
There is some discussion in this scientific community that, you know, perhaps this focus on attacking plaque and amyloid, that was short-sighted, and that actually what we should be doing is...
Well, that was the point. I mean, all those drugs were looking at what is the end result and asking, well, if we can only get rid of that plaque, everything's going to be okay. Now I think the focus is more on, well, why don't we get rid of that plaque? Because that plaque is developing all the time. And why do some brains get rid of that plaque a lot better than other brains? And that's about inflammation. That's the inflammatory system. That's being able to clear things or not let things deposit. And with that focus, I think we're going to change what the outcomes are going to be.
Right. So speaking of, this is something that I shared with you all in an email in advance, but you know, when we look at how quickly the technology is sort of hurtling forward, and then you look at these sort of experimental therapies, particularly immunotherapies. And, you know, there, you touched on this a little bit too, but there is, right now, there's a sort of unavoidable but huge gap of access of who actually gets to try these experimental therapies. And, you know, one of the things, we did a story in Time Magazine a little while ago about cancer immunotherapy, and there were four people in the story, and the lengths that they had to go to get into the trial, to stay in the trial, to afford moving to the place where the trial was being conducted in a desperate attempt to, you know, live longer, it's really hard from a sort of moral perspective, kind of getting your head around what these people are going through. And then at the same time, it's like, of course you're going to do everything that you can to get these experimental therapies. But it's something that I think about a lot, and I think it's something that you probably all have some sort of insight on this gap.
Well, I spent my life in clinical trials. And no matter, this is just a sad story, but you hear those stories all the time. And part of the reason that they happen, I'm now talking from the investigator's point of view, is that there are a lot of rule outs that rule people out for certain trials. And the reason you do that is to have the population that is going to give you the best chance of answering the question.
Right.
And a population that doesn't have a lot of the risks that could be associated. And there will always be many, many, many more patients who would like to be in a trial than are going to get into a trial. Now, for life-threatening conditions, the question that you raise is there a way to get those drugs to people faster or to make those trials more extensive? And there have been a lot of efforts now to expand the clinical trials and networks in cancers so that there are less of those accidents that happen. But we have to separate the accidents and the sad cases from the realities of certain people who just can't be in those trials. They're too early.
And the reality, yeah, that the trials need to be conducted in a very, very
specific
way.
Yeah. At the same time, I think, you know, for example, in cancer immunotherapies, I think even the most successful immunotherapies are only successful in maybe 15-20% of the patients. And of course, when it is successful, it's fantastic. But for the other 80 or 85%, they suffer the same side effects and adverse effects, but they don't have the benefits. So I think one of the things that's very important, it's hard in immunotherapy, but in some of the other targeted therapies, is really we need to have, while these therapies are being developed, we really need to push just as hard the companion diagnostics, the diagnostic tests, mm-hmm. to figure out in advance which of the patients are going to likely benefit from that drug, so that we can keep our costs down and focus the benefit on those who are going to benefit. I think that's actually really, really important.
Dr. Cosgrove, do you want to add on to that?
You know, I think they've hit on the important points. Clearly, the FDA is struggling with how to accelerate drugs through the trial process and at the same time keep the population safe and also have meaningful results when you're done with it. And that requires significant monitoring of who you put in the trial and who you don't and what are the other factors that could affect the trial. So it is a balancing act that we constantly strive to make more efficient, and it's not easy.
Finally, let's talk a little bit about CRISPR. So yesterday, the NIH approved the first trial in the States using CRISPR on human cells, not embryonic cells like they're doing in Europe, but on human cells. And you know, CRISPR is obviously being heralded as the single thing that will transform medicine from here on out. Not just medicine, crops, the way we genetically engineer viruses out of mosquito. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. How much do you think that's hype? How much do you think this is actually an incredible turning point for science?
I think it's probably.
And how worried are you about the downstream?
I'm not sure everybody's read your article, so maybe you ought to explain to them what CRISPR is.
Oh, I figured this room knew what CRISPR was. CRISPR is a relatively new, about 2 years old, gene editing technology that allows scientists to easily and inexpensively edit genes, edit DNA, and also now we think RNA. So the consequences of that are enormous. It's being tried right now in a lab setting on HIV. It's been the first trials on human embryos, which would be germline changes. So any edits done to sperm cells, eggs, or fertilized embryos, that any change that is made would be permanent, so through generations and generations. So obviously the implications of toying with CRISPR are significant, and currently in the United States, the NIH has a ban on using it on human embryos. They can't use public funding for it, but there are people raising their hands saying that they'll privately fund that kind of research. So there's a lot of debate going on around it right now. The potential is obviously enormous, and it's also extremely controversial. So
the genie's out of the bottle.
Right, exactly.
And this may be a point not unlike what happened in nuclear physics. When that genie got out of the bottle, there is no more powerful technology that has been invented yet for genomics than gene editing, for gene editing like CRISPR. And all my friends in genomic labs tell me the opportunities are extraordinary. The question will be the ethical issues it's going to raise and the safety that will be associated with it. There's just going to be an awful lot to learn here. There'll be an extraordinarily upside, and in the hands of unethical people, an extraordinary downside.
Yeah, and the downside, I think, you can obviously appreciate the upside as far as disease, but the downside is that it could, in fact, be a substantial risk to our communities with vectors being edited such that they'd be fatal for large portions of the population. And this is, so when you get into the human aspect, you don't know what the ultimate results are going to be. You get into animals and insects, et cetera, then you are opening up a whole big Pandora's box. So it is, it's clearly a two-edged sword.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that in the U.S. we have very good regulation around research, but globally we don't. And additionally, what we do in the U.S. really, you know, we can kind of create these international consortia and say, we all need to sign on together and follow these rules. But I think we're going to see a lot of global challenges.
So there are studies already ongoing for cystic fibrosis, and you can imagine that for those families who are affected by cystic fibrosis, the ability to cut out an edited gene and change a child's life seemed to be obvious and critical and something that they really want. There are studies that are being funded in cancer to improve immunological response and more effectively manage cancer. And you can see where people want those. But the flip side of this, I mean, imagine if you discover the genes that can affect intelligence. And some people, some parts of the world, think they can create a super race. What do you do with that?
Right. I mean, it's been called a potential weapon of mass destruction, not for super races, but also for super bugs. So, yeah, definitely. All right. Well, heavy topic to end on, but important. So now we'll turn to the audience. Just raise your hand if you have a question, and we'll start with you.
We need some mics, right? Here comes a mic.
Hi, thank you. I'd like to know what the hospitals are doing for an aging population. We discussed the Medicare, but people who are aging are having disabilities, such as hearing loss, visual, and physical challenges. And the question is, I'm curious how many of the hospitals have added hearing induction loops so communication with the doctors is clear, or having larger font on prescriptions, or any, you know, those are just examples. What are each of your hospitals doing to manage the change in the patients as they age?
This is a major question, and clearly what we're doing is, and one of the big things that happens in hospitals is falls. And falls wind up getting people's hips fractured with the fall, and so we're going through a whole process of trying to make sure that no one gets out of bed to try and go to the John by themselves, because that's frequently where it happens. We've taken cords out to prevent those. We've taken our risk of falling in the hospital down substantially. There's a precaution. It's a leaf that's put on the door for people with potential for falls. We've looked at grab bars in the bathrooms. We've looked at everything that you can imagine that we'll try to have the colors of the hospital that are appropriate to highlight things. This is an enormous undertaking across everything that involves healthcare and the aging population. But one of the major issues in the hospitals, seriously, is falls and fractures that go with that.
So we have a geriatrics department that's been a leader in America for a couple of decades. And we're acutely aware of the problems that you raise. So we have a separate geriatric clinic. We expect those physicians are especially trained in these issues. We have a separate part of our emergency room for geriatric patients, and again, with a separate staff who's trained in the difficulties in communicating. We have special plans around discharge that we do, and we have a very robust visiting docs program that serves the geriatric community.
I totally agree with you, and this is a problem that I think there are many, many more things that we can do. Very focused in addition to fall prevention, which I totally agree, it is one of the top causes of complications. We're very focused on the transition out from the hospital home. I think that that's difficult for everybody, particularly in the geriatric population. We're actually expanding our rehab facilities and then expanding our hospital at home capabilities, whether it's home physicians or nursing visits or the technology to keep communication between patients who are at home, their family members, and the healthcare providers. One of the things I think for us is that really geriatrics is going to become the majority of what we do, not a specialty anymore. And so it has to be now integrated in all of the training. So one of the things that we're really focusing on is in our residency training programs. So that in the past it was really limited to you did a geriatric fellowship, but now actually their geriatric training is really extending throughout most of our training programs. And I think that's very important.
I might just add that one of the things we found enormously successful is we now deliver the drugs to the patient before they go home.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So they don't have to go to the pharmacy with a prescription. They get it right there in the hospital before they leave. What'd you say?
Hearing loss.
Are your surgeons using clear masks? One of the issues that the hospitals are not addressing is hearing loss. So are your hospitals using clear surgical masks so people can read lips, putting hearing induction loops like Hopkins has done? Especially, they've done it starting in the audiology. I know I've approached Sinai on this.
No, we aren't.
And that is really critical because if you can hear the ask or hear the information, first off, you have then a lack of informed consent and a lack of information. And then it's relying on the people with, and it infantilizes the patient when you speak to the other person. So I'm wondering what the hospitals are doing more specifically on the hearing.
We haven't addressed clear masks.
So we're going to move on to the gentleman in the yellow. I think there's a, yeah.
Yes, you mentioned earlier communication. And if we talk about the patient that's sitting in a hospital bed and the communication with the surgeons and then with the other medical practitioners and their assistants and then the nurses, how is communication today improving in that area? And how many medical groups, hospitals, et cetera, are actively dealing with this, which is totally new? I think you mentioned that.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what we've done. We found that the biggest complaint that patients have about their hospitalization at Cleveland Clinic was communication and so with physicians. And so we took all of our physicians offline for a day and developed a course about communication for every one of them that we made them go to. We saw our scores go up substantially after that. And we also have boards in the room where we write on them, okay, who's your physician, what's the plan of care for the day? So we try to standardize the communication. But just take, just imagine what the issue is. We looked at a cardiac surgical patient going through the Cleveland Clinic. They are touched by 120 people during that period of time. So you can imagine it's a little bit like a game of telephone. That the messages it has to be worked on so it is not confusing to the individual. It's a big, big issue with complicated care in the hospital.
Now, are other major hospitals open, let's say Mount Sinai or Columbia Presbyterian, to actually, I have a friend that's dealing with this, that he is trying to get the communication to improve
Yeah, very, very assertively, very aggressively. You know, we have a survey that Toby referred to that measures how well you feel your doctor communicated with you. And we get those scores all the time. And our scores are very, very high in that area because we made it an extremely high priority. They have courses. There are expectations that starts from the departmental level down to the division level down, and they're monitored. And we take mistakes that we inevitably make as learning opportunities to see that we can do it better. Because, as Toby said, you know, hospitals, complicated places. You get touched by a lot of people. And we're pleased with the trajectory and how it's improved, but there's room to go.
I think all of us also are trying to provide as much of the standard information as we can online or available in other venues, because we know that there's a white coat syndrome. As soon as you're in the room with the physician, all of a sudden everything, you know, freezes and you don't take in anything. And so I think all of our health systems, we have online videos. How do you prepare for this procedure? What to expect? What to do afterwards? And I think that also helps.
And you know, I think the other thing that you have to say is the bigger, the sicker the patient, the harder the communication is. And one of the things that we've done is we have posted doctors' scores rank order by name. And we send it home so their wives can see it, too, or their loved ones. And that has done a lot to raise the scores.
Well, back there, gentleman in the white on the aisle. Yeah, you.
Hi there. I was just wondering if you could comment on the future of emergency departments in the role of your health facilities. I find that as an emergency physician with, you know, the Health Care Act as it is, it's really become a primary care clinic. And a lot of times the resources aren't there to match that need, particularly in the nursing and the ancillary staff. Is that a big focus of the three of your conglomerates? And if so, you know, what is the role of the ED moving forward?
Well, we have 7 EDs. In an urban center like we are in, and in some of the communities we're in, you're right, they've become de facto primary care clinics. And that's not what they should be. But alongside those EDs, we've seen, and I think we can all comment on this, the proliferation of urgent care. And a goal of our healthcare system is to keep people out of the emergency room when it's not necessary, and to bring people either to their urgent care centers or to enhance access through primary care and get people to be able to see their doctors more readily so that emergency rooms can really be for emergencies. You're shaking your head.
That's a really great utopian idea, but in practice, it's absolutely
that's right. Well, wait. Toby can tell you how well they do it, because they do it very well, and they're a model for how you can get same-day appointments. And around the nation, I think those of us who've seen that are trying to emulate that. But the reality is, because you're an emergency room physician and you know this, that it's still an overwhelming experience. And there aren't enough people, nurses, who like that job. They're hard jobs to fill, and they burn out a lot of the physicians. But what I can tell you is we have made it a high priority. We have a tremendous amount of resources invested in it. And we're trying to make sure that the emergency room gets the appropriate patients. But when you're in it with as many people as we have, and a lot of community hospitals that serve those communities close, and they close with their emergency rooms down, other hospitals become overwhelmed.
You know, there is something that's evolving in healthcare that also will drive that change, which is many of us as provider systems are increasingly becoming financially responsible for the patients, as also the insurance, as the health plans. So, for example, in our health insurance plan, when we first started looking at the data a few years ago, we had patients who used the ER 40, 50 times a year, right? And if you think about the cost that now we're responsible for, we are incredibly motivated to intervene. And so whether it's through care management or nurses or home or getting, you know, just Ubering them into their primary care visit and back, it's worth it for us to do that. And I think as we see some of those financial risks shifting, that's also going to see, you know, a decreased drive for the ER.
And I would say one more thing. We've adopted access, motto of access anywhere, anytime. And that is going to be virtual. And we, you now can pick up your laptop or your Skype and have a consult with a Cleveland Clinic physician. And we think that that is what is going to begin to change how millennials look at, particularly millennials, look at healthcare and how they get their delivery. But all of these are steps in beginning to try to make access better so you don't have to go to the emergency room to get it.
And it's also helpful in rural areas. I mean, I know those of you in New York, that doesn't apply to you. But in Utah or in Idaho and Montana, Wyoming, it's hugely helpful to have these virtual visits.
So I mean, just to give you an example, I mean, think about dermatology.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, dermatology, you know, my daughter got a rash on her face, and we're out on the East Coast, and I took a picture of it and then sent it to the dermatologist and said, yep, it's poison ivy. Now, think what that did. That saved the trip to Inden Park, to go to the doctor's office, to sit in the waiting room, to go sit in the doctor's office and see the senior and walks in and sees you, and then reverse the whole process. Okay. That's access. And that's the direction we're going with American Well and some other Teladoc and some other organizations across the country that are beginning to expand that sort of access.
I think we have time for two more questions, and I'd ask just to get straight to the question. The gentleman back there who we skipped before by accident. Yes, him.
Just a quick question. This is a fantastic discussion, but no one wants to talk about the behavior modification needed by the patient population themselves. Seems like it's a third rail or something. But we all, as citizens and potential patients, have responsibilities that seem to make demands on you all, more demands, but it's like it's an endless well of requests.
Okay, I'll tell you what I did, or what we did at the Cleveland Clinic. We thought there are two things that are preventable in terms of healthcare costs and wellness, and that is, one, smoking, which is the number one preventable cause of cancer in the United States, and two, obesity, which is now accounting for 10% of the healthcare costs in the United States. And, you know, so we took real steps in this, and we said, as an organization, we need to be a model for what this is. And so we stopped hiring smokers. And our incidence of smoking in Cleveland is 22%, and our incidence of our employees is 6%. Then we put a big push on food and on exercise. And we have, as an organization, lost over 500,000 pounds. It's a, you know, a journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. We got another 5 million to go.
All right, one more question. Woman, you've had your hand up for a while. You, yeah.
Me?
Yeah. Sorry. The woman, you.
Okay.
Had her hand up for a while.
Where do each of you see senior housing fitting into the value play that each of you have talked about today?
Whoa.
You want to start?
No, why don't I start with this? You know, I mentioned earlier that we're really interested in this hospital at home model. So we're actually in some very early conversations with some community groups who actually deal with senior housing or just facilitated home improvement for low-income families and so on. And we're trying to partner with them in order to help bring some of the technologies in and also provide care management services to the homes. Those we're initially piloting those projects with the families that we're financially at risk for, where we understand and we have the data because they're in our health plan for how many times they're getting readmitted or coming back to the hospital. And so we know they need additional services at home and support. That's probably the closest that I can get to answer your question.
I think that's That's a very good statement of what the problem is and where we are. But I'd like to use that as a springboard to talk about something a little broader around senior care and related systems like that. And that is, we talk a lot about how, you know, GDP, the largest percentage of GDP is taken by healthcare, that we're the worst in the Western world. I think we're 17.5% now, and we're going up to 20, and this is unaffordable, on and on and on. And that our healthcare outcomes are kind of lousy. If you're first in the world in percentage of GDP used in spending, why shouldn't your healthcare outcomes be the best? And part of the answer is, what affects senior housing? And the answer is, because social services in the United States are relatively minimal. And when you add the cost of what we spent, the expenditures on social service, to the expenditures that we have on healthcare, and you compare us to the rest of the Western world, we are actually just in the middle, just about where our healthcare outcomes are. So if we don't spend money in social services, in the kind of senior housing you talked about, but other kind of affordable housing relationships, you know, and low-income housing, and in schools, and in diet, and in food stamps, and all the kinds of things that are more effectively done in Western Europe, we're going to have the same kind of healthcare outcomes that we have, and we're going to continue to point to the guys who are on this panel and say, you're the profligate spenders, how come?
Yeah. I would say that if you stop and look at the life expectancy immediately around the Cleveland Clinic, it is 20 years less than the life expectancy in the suburbs. And that is around socioeconomic issues, employment, food, housing, social services of all kinds. And the question is this the responsibility of the healthcare providers? And if so, what are the resources that we're going to have to deal with those? Because childhood mortality rates are not affected by the quality of the pediatric intensive care unit. They're affected by the prenatal visits. And so there's a whole societal infrastructure that needs to be enhanced to begin to deal with these very important issues that are affecting both health and longevity across our society. So the question is are healthcare providers going to be the ones that are expected to do that, or are we going to look at a wider swath of social services that begin to interact with those issues? And that's, you know, we're having trouble just looking after the people that are sick. And, you know, to take on that additional burden is going to require additional resources. And it's certainly a huge expectation for us.
I would like to thank you all for coming today and for a wonderful panel.
Thank you.